Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC, and my next guest has such an interesting take on jobs, capitalism, and inequality that I wish we had about 3 hours to really delve into parts of this. Luigi Zingales is a mostly conservative economist who also gives real credence to certain progressive ideas. He's an immigrant from Italy whose crony capitalism helped inspire him to leave, now a University of Chicago professor, and author of a new book called A Capitalism for the People, Recapturing the Lost Genius of American Prosperity. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You write, and one of your central concepts is that being pro-free market is not the same as being pro-business. Why are they sometimes opposed to each other?
Entrepreneurs always want free market when they get into a market, but the moment they are into a market, they want to put barriers to entry and protect. And the difference is, as a defender of free markets, you want free markets when people get in and when they're already in. And so when you have a group of entrepreneurs or capitalists who want to expand into new markets, they tend to be pro-market, and the two things are aligned. Other times, when they defend their sort of vested interests, they are pro-business but not pro-free market.
But let me question that a little bit, because I gather that one of your central arguments is to have very light regulation, because government regulation tends to protect existing businesses, as you were just saying, over ones that want to enter and compete. But to liberals, regulations are things that protect the environment from corporate rapaciousness, protect consumers and shareholders from certain power imbalances that the market creates. So why frame regulation mostly in terms of barriers to competition?
It's because when you look into the details, most of the regulation ends up being that way. I think that liberals are right in desiring regulation that protects the environment, protects consumers, etc. But you want to see how the sausages are actually made. When you look how the sausages are made, regulation is about details. And the details are not monitored by the public at large, and they are shaped by the lobbies who are paid by the large corporations. So even if something starts with the principle of being like a great idea, in practice, doesn't end up that way.
Give me an example.
Oh, I think about the entire financial regulation plan and the Dodd-Frank Act and the Volcker Rule. I think that they started with the very legitimate goal of trying to curb the too-big-to-fail idea that is really anti-free market and anti-American, if I may say that. And so the intention was very good, as the intention of saying we don't want banks to gamble with our insured deposits is also a great idea. But then you look at the legislation, and the legislation, first of all, is 2,400 pages that suggest to have subsequent 67 studies that will bring to more pages of regulation. And when you look at the details, you realize that not much has been accomplished except sort of feeding lobbyists and lawyers who lobby on one side or the other.
But then why do the big banks, who are the insiders, hate this so much?
In part is they hate it so much because they would like to have zero regulation, which is not what I'm advocating, and in part because they are posturing. They cannot be saying we love it because then the entire scheme would fall apart. But think about sort of the Volcker Rule. I have a great respect for Paul Volcker. I think is a great man, and I think he has the right ideas. But his rule, or at least the way they try to implement it, is not enforceable. It requires understanding the intentions of people, and that's the reason why, in my book, I came down and say I think a total separation from of investment banking from commercial banking, like the old Glass-Steagall, at the end of the day is the right solution. Not necessarily is the best solution from an economic point of view, but is the best solution from a political economy point of view, because I don't come down and say we should have zero regulation. Mm-hmm. We should have regulation, but the regulation should be simple enough. I like to say that even congressmen understand it.
One interesting thing you said a moment ago is that the way the financial sector has developed in this country is un-American. Now, you're very concerned with what's American. You're an immigrant from Italy, escaping what you call the crony capitalism there. You write in your book about the unique American approach to prosperity and its relationship to freedom. So what do you find un-American about the financial sector, the way it had developed?
I think that one of the fundamental principles of this country is that people who do the right thing, who exert effort, etc., get rewarded, but people who do the wrong thing get punished. And I really admire the fact that even sort of very powerful people in this country end up in jail when they commit a fraud or they do something wrong, which is not true in my country. So I think that that's a very important characteristic. Now, the too big to fail is a doctrine that basically say if you are sufficiently politically influential, you can do whatever you want and you're not going to bear the cost of your mistakes. And that really takes away the incentives upon which the free market system is based. And it's bad not only for the economic consequences that this have, but also for the political consequences that this have, because then people say, why I sort of homeowner who bought my house at the peak of the market and now I'm severely underwater in my mortgage, why shouldn't I be bailed out? Why shouldn't we all be bailed out? And that becomes irresistible.
Luigi Zingales, University of Chicago economics professor and author now of A Capitalism for the People, Recapturing the Lost Genius of American Prosperity. One liberal premise that you accept that really surprised me, that despite Europe's bigger welfare state and America's more open markets, there is no more social mobility here than in other developed countries. And you say it's mostly just people at the top of our income ladder who think there is more social mobility than there is. Why doesn't that stat by itself blow to pieces the whole fundamental argument for go-go markets rather than more citizen guarantees?
Look, I don't accept the premise. I look at the data. I'm mostly an empirical economist, and I think that looking at the data is extremely important. And you have to look at the data with sort of a clear mind. And I have a chapter in my book talking about how important it is for people to get the data, because that can change minds, etc. And I have to say that coming to this country, and I was lucky enough to sort of come from Italy and have a great career here. So I'm a living example, if you want, of social mobility. But I have to look at the statistics, and the statistics are that this social mobility has been going down. And so the question is why and what can we do to fix it? Because I think that not having social mobility is bad from two points of view. First of all, generate resentment because people are willing to accept sort of a unequal system if they consider somehow fair. And one condition of fair is that everybody has a fair shot at getting to the top. So I think that not having a fair system generates resentment, but also it's a waste of talent. If you have great people who cannot go to the top, you're wasting talent. So on both counts, I think it's important to try to equalize the starting points. I don't play golf, but what I like of golf is the fact that in order to make the system competitive, you create some handicap up front so that everybody, regardless of their initial ability, can have a fair shot at winning a competition. And that's my view of the economy. We don't want to equalize the outcomes, but we want to try to, and it's impossible to do a perfect job, but at least go in the direction of equalizing the starting points.
But then if the U.S. Holds itself up as so different from Europe, why do the social mobility rates not come out any better?
Because I think that, there are aspects, for example, the public education system in Europe that function relatively better than in the United States. And actually, paradoxically, the countries in Europe that do the best are the Scandinavian countries that are portray very often as an example of socialists. But in fact, they are an interesting combination of some sort of more welfare state, but some other things that are more like flexible and really market oriented. And in terms of education, there are some international statistics that put Finland at the top of the quality of education that gives to its children. And having sort of a good education for everybody, not just the lucky one who end up living in the expensive neighborhood, I think is a fundamental point to equalize the starting point in our society.
Luigi Zingales, his book, A Capitalism for the People, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You also seem to accept the liberal argument that Wall Street has too much power over government policy because of campaign finance and lobbying laws. What do you see at the heart of what you call legalized bribery?
I don't know whether it's a liberal argument. I think it's a sort of, again, is a fact more than a liberal argument. And honestly,
well, conservatives are for Citizens United and those kinds of things that let the money flow.
But it's interesting because, you know, this theory of capture started actually at Chicago by George Stigler, who was clearly a very conservative economist. And I'm simply sort of consistent with this theory. If sort of we are concerned about too much influence of the incumbents on regulation, we are concerned about lobbying. And from an economic point of view, there is no indication that the amount of lobbying that we have is optimal. In fact, everything goes in the direction of saying that there is too much of it. And I'm actually using another sport example. Conservative economist Robert Barrow is in favor generally of everything sort of being free. It is in favor of capping baseball and NBA salaries because he recognized that in a sort of winner-take-it-all game, there might be overinvestment of the single parties to win the game. And lobbying has exactly the same characteristics. So if we are ready to cap the salaries of players, why don't we try to cap the salaries of lobbyists in some ways?
We'll continue in a minute with Luigi Zingales and take some of your phone calls for him. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with University of Chicago economist Luigi Zingales. His new book is called A Capitalism for the People, Recapturing the Lost Genius of American Prosperity. And you were just telling me in the break that you see certain commonalities between the Occupy movement and the Tea Party.
Absolutely. I think that both these movements are fueled by a resentment against a system that they don't seem fair to them. And I think they channel this resentment in a different direction. It says the Tea Party is mostly about a overpowering government that sort of is taxing too much and takes away freedom. The Occupy Wall Street movement, or the Occupy movement in general, is more about the excessive power of large corporations. But there are two sides of the same coin. In a sense, do you think that Fannie Mae is sort of a source of problems because it's government sponsor, because a large corporation, or because of both? I think it's the intermingling of government and business that really create the biggest problems, not only in our economy, but historically. And this is, I think very few people know that the Boston Tea Party was not about higher taxes on tea. In fact, the taxes on tea imports went down, but they went down in a differential way because the East India Company got a bigger discount than the local American importers. And so the local American importers were revolting against this differential that was destroying them. And the East India Company is the ultimate example of crony capitalism, of intermingling of the power of the government and the power of the corporation.
Joan in Manhattan calling in on upward mobility. Hi, Joan. Joan hung up as soon as I picked up the phone. Let's try Jack in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Jack.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
You mentioned before that the banks, they got big bailouts and the homeowners didn't. So if that has to do with, like, New York City's economy, I don't know, it's the 12th largest economy in the world or something, would that mean that the crony capitalism here is kind of skewed towards, you know, away from the average person, or?
Right. So is there a New York angle on this?
I think it's probably sort of a U.S. angle. And it's just in New York, certain business is more concentrated and more powerful. But I think it's a U.S. angle. Unfortunately, if it was just limited to New York, it would be easier to sort of contain it. And actually, I have to say that historically, if anything, the anti-New York bias helped keeping the power of finance in check. And this bias has disappeared, and I think rightly so, because we are in a global world. It doesn't make sense to have a tension between Chicago and New York when the sort of the competition is between Asia and the United States. But I think as a result, the power of a few industries, and finance in particular, has grown very large.
You do characterize the Occupy movement as making it harder to reform the financial system by rejecting the whole thing. But I could argue that most occupiers don't reject Western capitalism. They don't want Soviet, you know, socialism. They don't want a strongman Berlusconi. They want meaningful rules of the road, like no Citizens United, tilting the government toward the rich, no securitization of mortgages that allow bankers to peddle bad loans because they can sell away the risk, no special low tax rate on capital gains for paper investments when physical work is taxed at a higher rate, the Buffett rule. That's the crony capitalism most occupiers would say they're out there to reject. And they'd see something like Fannie Mae, which was at least trying to get more low-income people into homes, as less of the problem. How much of that would you disagree with?
I think that I disagree in that Fannie is less of a problem. I think that, unfortunately, the most effective form of lobbying is the one with the best ideas, or the best sort of most appealing ideas. So home ownership is something that is very hard to resist. Nobody can speak against sort of increasing home ownership. And as a result, the amount of the subsidy that not the individuals received, that would have been sort of not so bad, but the shareholders and Fannie and the managers of Freddie was indecent, and it still is. So I think that my disagreement is they don't see the argument in all the details. And when you look at the reality, most sort of left-leaning people tend to be in favor of this public-private partnership, because they think that there are the social goal of a public corporation and the efficiency of a private corporation. And my claim is that it's actually the other way around. This has the social goal of a private corporation and the efficiency of a public corporation. Every time you have a public-private partnership, I think you have business sort of getting more money at the expense of the taxpayers.
We are just about out of time. We have Congressman Daryl Issa standing by, who's about to come on. But let me just get your two very quick takes, if you can do it in quick takes, on big things in the news. On debt and stimulus, mm-hmm, during the prolonged slump we're in, Paul Krugman was here Monday, different kind of economist, and said this is a great time for government to borrow money to stimulate the economy because low interest rates make it so cheap, and the deflationary spiral we see from not stimulating risks a decade or more of stagnation like in Japan. What's your quick take on how much you agree?
I think that in 2009, when the world was on the brink, I thought that having some stimulus was not a bad idea. Today, I think that we have to live with a new normal, and spending more will push us in the direction of Greece.
And regarding Europe, your old home, one thing happening right now is that they're deciding if and how to bail out Spain's banks and are torn on whether to do it with the punishing austerity terms that have crippled the Greek economy. Where do you come down on that?
I think that the terms on Greece were too harsh. I do believe that the financial sector must pay for their mistakes. I think that Greece made a mistake by borrowing too much. There were other people that made a mistake by lending to Greece too much. They both should share the cost. And so far, basically, Greece has paid all the cost and the financial sectors has paid none. So I was in favor of some form of debt restructuring, not now, but in 2010.
Very interesting economist, Luigi Zingales, independent thinking, an original book called The Capitalism for the People, Recapturing the Lost Genius of American Prosperity. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.